We'll begin.
Okay.
Okay, so this week's parsha is Parsha Shoftim, and the title is, Can a Rabbi Permit Driving to Shul on Shabbat? As you know, in 1951, the Rabbinical Assembly, the conservative arm of the rabbinical arm of the conservative movement, permitted riding in a car to go to your closest shul if you live in a distant part, you know, if it's beyond walking distance. They did not permit driving in general on Shabbat, and they only allowed literally being driven to shul. Well, you know how that ended up. That ended up being basically, you know, driving to shul became allowed. Driving on Shabbat became allowed. It was, you know. Anyways, without going into that famous rabbinic decision, basically, as we're going to soon see, that the Judaism that we observe is through the medium of the oral law. Who are the guardians of the oral law?
Generations of scholars, I mean, and also just the general people, but scholars mostly.
Right. So we'll call them the rabbis in a general term. We'll get to more specifics now. So Judaism that we observe is fundamentally what some people call rabbinic Judaism. That's not so accurate, because it's a Torah Shabbat Peh Judaism would be more accurate. But we're going a little ahead. I want to back up, because this week's Parsha deals with the fundamental role of rabbinic leadership, rabbinic authority, rabbinic power, and its limitation, okay? Which is a foundational idea in Judaism, and it affects us every single day. So let's start with the beginning. So I'm asking, so the Parsha opens up, what is the obligation when the Jews enter the land of Israel? What must they establish?
Appoint judges and police.
Correct. So according to the Torah Shabbat Peh, it's not just random judges. What do they actually have to establish? Just a bunch of judges? You're a judge?
No, they have to administer honest judgment for the people.
Correct. So what do we call a group of judges when they administer justice?
A Beis Din.
A Beis Din. This was the first initiated by, of course, we saw that by Yitro. All right. So they're not just simply independent judges, but they gather together and they form courts. What's the smallest Jewish court?
Three people.
Three judges, correct. What is the smallest court to adjudicate capital punishment cases? Advanced question.
Isn't it 11?
How many judges do you need to adjudicate a capital determine any kind of punishments? Capital punishments. Corporal punishments. Twenty-three. And that's called a Sanhedrin Kitana, a small Sanhedrin. Now, let's say the local, and where do they have to establish that in the land of Israel?
The Sanhedrin?
No, a court.
Oh.
In each tribe.
So it's one court per tribe? How many courts? So it says in all your settlements, all your towns. So any town, according to any town that has 120 people, must have a court, a Beis Din. Okay? In the land of Israel, the level of the requirement is much greater. In outside land, it has to be every city. Okay? So you have to set up a institution of of the court system with the judges. Now, what are the police? What's their role? And this is a question for those who were in the class last year. This is an extra credit. What is the role of the police in the Jewish court system?
Wasn't that to make sure that businesses were operating fairly and that they weren't ripping each other off?
Right. So they went out to the shuk, the Machane Yehuda of that time, okay? And they're going through the court, going through the various stalls and making sure people's measurements are precise. What is the squad car composed of? It's from last year. Sean, you remember, Sean?
Isn't it like a rabbi and the police person?
Correct. Good, Moshe Kandel, very good. It is both the dayan, the judge, and the police officer. And the police officer cannot, in contrast to American law, where the police officer functions and operates autonomously, sort of as a messenger of the court, here he can't do anything. If the judge saw something untoward, a guy was like ripping people off, he would tell him to give him a potch, you know, to give him a little bit of a smack. So he would be sort of he's sort of the arm of the judge, okay? And they would do that, and they go through the business areas of, you know, the marketplace of every town. All right. Now, let's say a question comes up to the court of that town, and they are unable to solve it. What do they do?
They go to the Supreme Court.
They go to the Supreme Court. Where is the Supreme Court located, according to the Torah?
Where Hashem chooses.
Okay, so what is that referring to?
Jerusalem.
Well, not always.
The temple.
The Mishkan, and those who went to Israel, where did the Mishkan spend a lot of time?
Shiloh
for 369 years. So, and it traveled around in the campus of the Mishkan / Migdash. The Sanhedrin is located in a room. Okay, so they have the campus there. In the campus, they have a place for the Sanhedrin to be. And when they moved it to Yerushalayim, guess how many courts they had on the campus? I may have mentioned this in another class. So the Sanhedrin Gedola is in a room, in a chamber, adjacent to the very close to where the Mizbeach is, where they're doing the offerings. And they have two other smaller, you know, called Sanhedrin Kitana, a court of 23. Two of them are on the campus. You have a total of three courts: the Supreme Court, the Sanhedrin Gedola, the Grand Court, 71 members. And then we got the other two smaller Sanhedrins with 23. So you go to the court, if you weren't able to, you go to a higher court. Just like that is what we have in America. You have an appellate division and you have the Supreme Court. You have different levels of, depending on each state that does it a little bit differently. And the case, if it's unable to be clarified, know what to do, the court will push it to the higher level of court. Okay? Now, let's say you have a case and can't be solved, and you go to the place, you go to the Mizbeah, the Mishkan or the Beit HaMikdash and Yerushalayim, where it was finally in the time of Shlomo situated. What do? Just from based on the Pesukim here.
You go to the Levite priests.
The court's only made up of Levite priests?
And other members of the Supreme Court.
Right. So now why does the Torah say that the Supreme Court, the Sanhedrin, is going to have Levitical priests you know, Kohanim and Levium.
Because the Levites were the teachers, so obviously the court has to have someone, a Levite, on it.
Right, since they're basically not working their land, and they're involved in teaching, and part of that education is that they're going to be trained to be judges. It's really part of their identity. So really, they should be on the court. Now, if there are nobody, if there are any no Levium or Kohanim who are qualified, then you don't stick one on there just for you know cosmetic purposes. But they're likely to be there because that's their essential role, as it says in Moses' blessing to the tribe of Levi on his last day, talks about them adjudicating, providing legal direction to the court. Now. All right, so you go to them, and they make a decision. How do they make a decision? We'll go into this more deeply.
They interpret the Torah?
They interpret the Torah. Okay, and they'll give you the... And if they come to a decision, what's the mandate?
That you follow their decision.
Okay, so here's a very important thing. So basically... The Torah itself, God gave mankind, and particularly the Sanhedrin, the power to interpret the Torah. So if you walk away with only one piece of information tonight, this is the most basic fact, is that the Torah gave the Sanhedrin power to interpret, and we'll see more, a little more, power over the Torah. The Torah, as we say, is lo bashamayim. Later on in Devarim we'll see, it's no longer in heaven, which means that we don't get in contrast when before it was canonized, when Moshe had a question, when the daughter of Slavka came to Moshe, who did he ask? Did he ask his court?
Moshe asked God.
So at that point, the Torah was still in heaven. In other words, if he had a question and he was stumped, he wouldn't discuss it with his court of 71. He would ask God. God would tell him what the Torah is because the Torah was not finalized. Moses' last day, he finishes writing down the corpus of the Torah. The Torah is sealed. At that point, it's no longer in the hands of God anymore. What does that mean? What is the implication of that? Something very people don't think about it.
Things that aren't explicitly said in the Torah, we have to figure out how the Torah applies to them.
Right. Well, they're going to have certain rules we read it every in the davening we have Rabbi Shmuel, you know Shlosh Esrei Midos HaTorah Nidreshim, where the 13 laws is the Torah explicated. You know, the fancy word is hermeneutical laws. So the bottom line is that it was given over to the court to explain. What is it now? What is it? What is a feature of mankind?
We have a bias.
We have bias. We're finite, and therefore we're fallible. So they can make mistakes. Okay? Does that make a difference?
Not in the legislative process for the Torah, it doesn't.
No, because what they determine is the law, that's the law, because no longer in God's hands. Okay? Now, there is a system, if they make a mistake, there's a whole tractate about when they mess up. So they can, you know, they have to bring a korban. There's a whole process. But, but mistakes are possible. Okay, but what's the law? But what's the law in the land?
Whatever they decide.
Okay, that's it. And they say it four ways. Let's read it out to 17:10. Okay, Shana, read. Just read those those two psukim, 10 and 11.
Since this decision comes from the place that God shall choose, you must do as they tell you, carefully following their every decision. Besides this, in general, you must keep the Torah as they interpret it for you and follow the laws that they legislate for you. Do not stray to the right or left from the word that they declare to you.
All right, stop right there. What is strange about what question just leaps out at you from these two verses? So I'll give you a hint. If you were an editor, what would you do to these psukim?
I would take out follow the laws that they legislate for you. Because they're supposed to be just interpreting and applying, not making new ones.
Okay, well, that's a good question.
I have another one.
Dad?
It says, since this decision comes from the place that God shall choose, so, like, why the place versus, like, God himself?
Well, because God's not communicating to her anymore. That's it. It's done. He's out.
Right, so the relevance of, like, the place, that must be, like, very significant.
Right, so that's a good question. So what in other words, that would imply that Sanhedrin would leave the Temple Mount, which during the Roman persecution they did. They had ten exiles, and their final location was in Tiberia, which those people went on heritage were in Tiberia. That was their last place, and the halacha is that if they go out, if they leave the court, they cannot do any, there's certain cases, they can't do a capital punishment case. Which gets back to Sean's question, is, well, one second. If they have the best legal minds, the best Jewish legal minds, why should the fact that they're in the Beit HaMikdash make a difference? Okay, so that's a good question. What else is strange, or would you edit, or whatever?
It makes me nervous that it says you must keep the Torah as they interpret it for you, because we have so many different interpretations of things.
Right.
And why does it reiterate so many different ways that you must listen to what they say? Because now you have to ask what each one of these adds to the last one.
Correct. That's a question I was sort of hinting for you guys to grab onto. Thank you, Moshe. So it seems to be saying that you can just say simply, when you make a query, they'll declare to you a legal decision, and you must listen to them. Done. No. Since it's come from the place that Hashem shall choose, you must do as they tell you. One, carefully following their every decision. Two, besides you must keep the Torah as they interpret it. Three, and follow the law they legislate you. Four, and do not stray from the right or left from the word that they declare to you. So it's like, four or five ways of saying basically you are bound by their legal ruling. Okay? Now, it's interesting. Let's go to 12 and 13. Let's make it a little more spicy. All right, let's go ahead. Let's go to Suzanne.
If there is any man who rebels and refuses to listen to the priest or other judge who is in charge of serving God, your Lord, there as leader of the Supreme Court, then that man must be put to death, thus ridding yourselves of evil in Israel. When all the people hear about it, they will fear and will not rebel again.
Okay, now, one second. So if you don't follow the court, it seems on the surface that what? You get the death penalty. But it's not talking about just generally not following the rabbis. It's talking about a man who rebels. We're talking about another judge. Let's say you have a case. Let's say because remember, they go by majority rules. So you have 71. So let's say you have 40 judges say it's permitted and 31 say it's forbidden, right? Okay. And let's say you're a judge you're part of the 31 group. And you know what? You think that you have the halacha clear so absolutely clearly that you think they're just wrong. They're just making a mistake. And somebody comes to you and asks you what the halacha is and says, you know what? The halacha is it's forbidden. It's not permitted. That court is wrong. The case in the Talmud, they called it a Zakein Mamre, the rebellious elder. Bum, bum. And he's, because what he's doing, he's a guy who's part of the system of judges. He's part of the Dayanim, and he's breaking with them. The rule is that if once the decision is made and the majority rules, even the minority who feels very passionately that they were correct are not allowed to rule against that. They cannot pop. Now, what interesting halacha, we might see this, is that they could give a shiur to their students, say, you know, I theoretically think that the halacha is it's prohibited, but the Sanhedrin has permitted it. You know what I'm saying? He's not asked to give away his mind. You know what I'm saying? So if he thinks it's halacha from his vast vision of Judaism and understanding of all the mitzvot and of all its intricacies, that really the halacha is A and the court is B, as long as he doesn't paskin, render a legal decision against them, he can explain like a theoretical, like a giving a shir like right now, he can give over his point of view. You know what I'm saying? But we're talking about a guy who is one of the Dayanim who is rebelling against the system. Okay? Now, with this learning of the basic psukim, I want to accomplish tonight with the 30 minutes we have left. I just want to do together with you five halachot. But these are five halachot which are so, so critical to really understand how, you know, I'll use the general, the rabbis or the Sanhedrin operate. And also jump back today, what is the role of a rabbi in 2017? Okay, that's our goal, is to understand the entire legal system from a helicopter view, what the roles of the rabbis are in general, what is their role, what is not their role, and what's happening in the world now after the Sanhedrin has ceased. Okay, so let's read it together. Let's have Shana read halacha number one.
The Supreme Sanhedrin in Jerusalem are the essence of the oral law. They are the pillars of instruction from whom statutes and judgments issue forth for the entire Jewish people. Concerning them, the Torah promises, "You shall do according to the laws which they shall instruct you." This is a positive commandment. Whoever believes in Moses and in his Torah is obligated to make all of his religious acts dependent on this court and to rely on them.
All right, stop right there. Now, this is a very important statement here. This is a big one. The Supreme Court is the essence of the oral law. Ikar Torah Sheba'al Peh. What does that mean? So what is the oral law? Let's start with the most basic question. What is the oral law?
It's the laws and commentary that Hashem gave to Moshe when Moshe was writing the Torah.
Right. It's the explanation of the Torah, which was given from God to Moshe and passed down. Okay? So whatever the formulation of the Sanhedrin is concerning that, that is the Torah Sheba'al Peh. Or where is the Torah Sheba'al Peh? Where is it located?
Wherever the Sanhedrin is.
In the mind of the Sanhedrin, correct. Their formulation, okay, is the Torah Sheba'al Peh. So in a certain sense, their formulation of what the mitzvos are is really Judaism. Okay? And you have following that is a mitzvah. Al pi ha'Torah Asher Yiruach, according to the law that they instruct you to do. That's a mitzvah, the commandment. Okay. All right. Let's take it slowly. So that's the first point. Halacha number two. Go ahead, Shana.
Any person who does not carry out their directives transgresses a negative commandment. Do not deviate from any of the statements they relate to you, neither right nor left. Lashes are not given for the violation of this prohibition, because it also serves as a warning for a transgression punishable by execution by the court. For when a sage rebels against the words of the court, he should be executed by strangulation, as the following verse states, a person who will act deliberately.
Okay. All right. So the, all right. So here's the thing. If any time a person does not follow the Sanhedrin, you violate a lotase. Okay. For example, so what we're going to see later on, so let's give the three examples, what they are. Go on.
We are obligated to heed their words, whether they learn them from the oral tradition, i.e. the oral law.
Stop right there. So, for example, the most simple case is like this. The Torah says on the first day of Sukkot, you shall take a pre-Eitz Hadar, a fruit of the goodly fruit of the tree. Okay? What is that? What is the Torah Shel Peh says is that fruit?
The etrog.
The etrog. So let's say I'm going to come to shul on the first day of Sukkot. I think that the goodly, that the pre-Eitz Hadar, the fruit of the goodly tree, is a nectarine. I have a beautiful nectarine, and I think that's a beautiful fruit, and I'm going to bring that. And that also is a fruit of a goodly tree, right? It's a goodly fruit. So if I do that, not only will I not fulfill the mitzvah of lulav, because I'm bringing my own fruit, which is not an etrog, I violate a lotase, because I'm arguing that I'm saying that the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, is not what they're saying. I'm saying it's not an etrog. I'm saying it's a nectarine. Okay? So that's category number one. Next, malacha. Let's say I'm going to say that driving a car is not malacha. If there's no, a malacha is exertion. This is not exertion. It's not malacha. So according to the Torah Shebaal Peh, it's got nothing to do with exertion. You can, as you know, all Shabbos, lift a sofa from the basement to the attic, and from the attic to the basement, and you will be bathed in sweat. Did you violate the prohibition of doing malacha on Shabbos?
No.
So if I'm going to say, so because malacha has nothing to do, is not about exertion. It's about transforming material based upon a design. It's a creative act, the technological creative act of transforming materials based upon a design. I have a blank sheet of paper. Now I have a written document. I have an uncooked steak. Now I got a grilled steak. I have yarn, now I have a sweater. Okay? It's always transforming material based upon design. Okay? It's got nothing to do with physical exertion. So if I say malacha is is exertion, well, I'm denying the oral law. Okay? All right, second category of what they do. Number two, go on.
Derive them on the basis of their own knowledge through one of the attributes of biblical exegesis, and it appeared to them that this is the current interpretation of the matter.
Okay, so in addition to some definition of terms, Moshe also gave the Jewish people, and particularly the elders, laws of interpretation. Okay, so that they can figure out new laws, because when do you need to have a new law? When you have a new circumstance, which is not overt from the existing situation. So they gave them certain laws, certain methods of derivation from the psukim to figure out new cases. Okay? All right, now, so that's really dealing with what tried, and that really is about explaining what the Torah law is. Now they add you something which is completely not in the Torah, it's completely rabbinic. Category number three. Go ahead.
Instituted the matter as a safeguard for the Torah, as was necessary at a specific time. These are the decrees, edicts, and customs instituted by the sages.
All right, so let's do each one at a time. So the word, the Hebrew word for decrees is gezerot. For example, on Shabbat, I cannot move tools used for malacha, lest I come to use them. So I'm not allowed to move a pen or a hammer or a wrench. What do we call that?
Muksa.
Move it. Called moving muksa, tiltal muksa. The rabbis created that. Why did they create that legislation, that decree?
So that you won't have the tool in your hand and say, oh, I can just use this to do whatever it is and then do it.
Right. Because if I'll move the tool, I might end up using the tool. If I got the pen in my hand, I might jot down a note. And therefore, so they did it to protect the Torah. Okay? The next one is called edicts. The Hebrew is called takanot. For example, every 3 days, the Jewish people have what? What do they always do every 3 days?
Torah reading.
Torah reading is correct. That's the first takana that Moshe instituted, was communal Torah reading. Monday, Thursday, Shabbat. Okay? So it's there to enhance by having public Torah reading to make sure that a certain level of Torah is the Jewish people are engaged in Torah study. Third is customs. Customs. They make minhagim, customs. So, what's a good example? What's a good example? One example of a custom that you may not be aware is a custom is the second day of Yom Tov outside the land of Israel. The Sanhedrin made, for a lot of reasons, instituting, we treat the second day of Yom Tov as a full day of Yontif. We treat it, because of doubt, we treat it as a full day of Yontif. That was a minhag, a custom that the Sanhedrin set up. Okay? So the two, for the A and the B, are really, they're really managing the understanding of the Torah law, A and B. And then the C is really their own protection of the Torah law. So is everybody, before I go on, is everybody clear on the three aspects of the Torah Shaval Peh that they're involved in?
I'm a bit fuzzy on B. Can you give a couple of examples of B?
So, for example, who has heard the Kal Vachomer? Have you heard the phrase, the Kal Vachomer argument?
Yeah, it means an extrapolation. If we know this, then that.
Okay, so let me just... So in the daily davening, right before we start Pesukah Zimmer, there's a paragraph called Rabbi Shmuel Haya Omer. Rabbi Shmuel Omer. The 13 rules in the Torah elucidated. So therefore, and he gives an example. Kal Vachomer is number one. So I'll give you, so Uncle Arshkroll gives us an example. I'll read it to you. Logic dictates that if in a lenient case has a stringency, the same stringency applies to a stricter case. Another way of putting it is that laws can be derived from less obvious situations and applied to more obvious situations. For example, it is forbidden to pluck an apple from a tree on the festivals when food may be prepared by cooking and other means that may be prohibited on the Shabbat. So certainly plucking it is forbidden on Shabbat. Conversely, it is permitted to slice vegetables on Shabbat. It is certainly permitted to do so on the festivals. Okay? So Kal Vachomer is one of the 13 rules, and in fact there are others, that they're able to, with the learning of the Psukim, to figure out new case law. Okay? The Gemara is filled with this, a Gezeirah Shava, okay? They learn the law of insofar as a classic case. How does a couple get married? Through the process of a transaction through money, okay? So it's learned from what they call Kicha Kicha Miste Ephron. They learn from the case when Avram purchased the land from Ephron, Ephron the Hittite, and the same term is used, and there's a tradition that therefore the same legal mechanism or principle applies. So there's a whole bunch of examples where they learned new laws, like how do you get married? Because the Torah just says you get married. It doesn't tell you how to get married. You know, that in fact that there are three ways of getting married in Judaism. Okay? All right. So that's the basics here. Now let's just go on. Now, let's go on. All right, Shani, doing a great job reading. Go ahead.
It is a positive commandment to heed the court with regard to each of these three matters. A person who transgresses any of these types of directives transgresses a negative commandment. This is derived from the continuation of the above verse in the following manner.
Stop right there. So really, the Rambam is really answering Michael Doze's question because he's bothered by the seeming superfluousness of telling you got to follow the Sanhedrin. Okay. Go ahead.
According to the laws which they shall instruct you, this refers to the edicts, decrees, and customs which they instruct people at large to observe to strengthen the faith and perfect the world.
But stop right there. So when the Torah says you got to listen to the law that they tell you, according to the laws they instruct you, refers to the rabbinic laws. So there's many of the Shabbat, most of the stuff that we do on Shabbat, we observe on Shabbat, are rabbinic add-ons to Shabbat. The laws of kashrut, biblically, can I have a chicken cheese sandwich? Biblically. Can I have chicken parmesan?
Yes. Biblically, yes.
Yes, I can. So the rabbis, the Sanhedrin, at a certain point, made it prohibited. Okay? For whatever reason. I'll give you another example. Shabbat is filled with them. Biblically, a person could be alone with another could be alone with two women, but the rabbi says you couldn't be even alone with two women. Or a certain extent, basically their model is to extend, either to extend biblical law or to make a new law that strengthens it. They made laws about commerce to ensure that people are, both buyer and seller are treated properly.
How is that not construed as adding to the Torah?
I was waiting for somebody to ask that question. And guys, I did not give fee before the class, Michael Doze. But so the question, in fact, the Rambam asked is, well, is this adding to the Torah? So I'm going to bounce the question right back to all you guys. When the rabbis say we're going to make a new law called Muksa, I can't move a pen on Shabbos, is that adding to the Torah? The Torah says many times, especially in Devarim, you cannot add or subtract to the Torah. You can't add the 614th mitzvah. So if I have to follow their law about muksa, is that not the 614th mitzvah?
Well, that's the safeguard so that you can follow the mitzvah of keeping Shabbat.
Yeah, but Michael Doe's asking you, but isn't it adding to the Torah?
The Torah is telling us to, or telling the Sanhedrin at least, to interpret the Torah.
Okay.
And so this is one of their interpretations of when the Torah says to remember the Sabbath and keep it holy, by identifying things as muksa is making sure that you keep the Sabbath and keep it holy.
Okay, good. I'll add one more thing. They're allowed, provided they make it very clear that what? They say this is not a Torah law. They follow their mandate, exactly what Shana says. We're going to make the thing muksa. It's strengthening it with it says in the Ten Commandments to keep the Shabbos day and make it holy by refraining from even moving objects of malacha. Okay? But this is not a Torah mitzvah. This is a rabbinical mitzvah. Provided they make it clear, they are not saying this is a 614th mitzvah. It's not adding on. Adding on is saying this is the 614th mitzvah. That would be a violation of the prohibition of adding to the Torah. Okay, is that clear? They have to have a very clear disclaimer. This is not a Torah law. Okay? And we're going to see another manifestation of that coming up in the next halacha.
Well, are we supposed to view Torah and rabbinic law like equally? Like, really shouldn't like, we shouldn't like, oh, we can transgress the rabbinic law because it's only rabbinic.
No, we see clearly when a person violates a rabbinic law, what do they in fact also violate?
The Torah.
Biblical law.
The biblical law of listening to their rabbi. So I say I'm not going to follow the law of Muksa. So one is I'm violating the rabbinic obligation of not moving Muksa. And I'm also violating the biblical law of not listening to them. Mm-hmm. They told the Jewish people, they made a piece of legislation that you can't move tools of Muksa on Shabbos. And I'm saying, no. I'm not going to listen. So really, to violate rabbinic law is also to, in fact, violate the general law of you must listen to the rabbis in regard to their legislation.
So I guess to put this in better context, you always give this example when you have like your Pesach like hotline. You give this famous example of the guy who was going to a Seder and he wants to know if he could like take the train, drive, like some other modes of transportation, and you kind of like guide him to choose the one that was like less a Torah violation, but really correct. It was all like violations, like equally in a sense, right?
Right. So he's going to get to that. We're going to save that question. That he's going to himself discuss that very question.
Okay.
You know, we're only up to the second law. We want to get to two more. All right. Hopefully. All right. Go on.
From all things that they will tell you. This refers to the tradition which they received from
do the one before that. According to the judgment they relate.
According to the judgment which they relate, this refers to the matters which they derive through logical analysis, employing one of the methods of biblical exegesis.
Right, so that's the using the Kal Vachomer, the various laws of extrapolation from the Torah to make new case law. And the last one?
From all things that they will tell you, this refers to the tradition which they received one person from another.
Right. So that's a tradition that's saying like, so when it says eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, if a person injures somebody and knocks out their tooth, the court does not knock out the other guy's tooth. He has to pay financial compensation. That's a Kabbalah. That is a tradition that's what the term means. And when it says, the fruit of the goodly tree refers to an etrog, not a nectarine. Okay? So the Rambam basically answers Moshe Chaim Doz's question and basically saying that each phrase that you have to listen to refers to the three different aspects of their legislative power, rabbinic power. Okay, go on.
There can never be any difference of opinion with regard to matters received through the oral tradition. Whenever there arises a difference of opinion with regard to a matter that shows that it was not received into tradition from Moses, our teacher.
Okay, so for example, there's never a machlokes about whether or not the fruit of the goodly tree is an etrog. There was never, it wasn't a Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai says, Beit Hillel says it's an etrog, and Shammai says it's a nectarine. Never happened. But where there is an argument, it means that there was no specific tradition about that particular point from Sinai. Okay, go on.
The following principles apply with regard to matters derived through logical analysis. If the entire body of the Supreme Sanhedrin agrees with regard to them, their consent is binding. If there is a difference of opinion, we follow the majority and decide the matter according to the majority. Similarly, with regard to the decrees, edicts, and customs, if a portion of the judges perceived that it was necessary to issue a decree, institute an edict, or establish a custom for the people, and a portion perceived that it is not appropriate to issue this decree, institute this edict, or establish this custom, the judges should debate the matter back and forth. Afterwards, a vote is called, and we follow the majority and execute the matter according to the decision of the majority.
Right, so it's very simple. Majority rules, you know, so therefore, gets to halacha number four, read on.
When the Supreme Sanhedrin was in session, there was never any prolonged differences of opinion among the Jewish people. Instead, if a doubt arose in a Jew's mind over any law, he would inquire of the court in his city. If not, the questioner in that court, or its agents, ascend to Jerusalem and ask the court which holds sessions on the Temple Mount. If they know, they will reply to him. If they do not know, everyone comes to the court that holds sessions at the entrance to the temple courtyard. If they know, they will reply to him. If they do not know, everyone comes to the chamber of hewn stone, to the Supreme Sanhedrin, and presents the question. If the matter that was unresolved by all the others was known to the Supreme Sanhedrin, either as part of the oral tradition or because of its derivation through the principles of exegesis, they relate the decision immediately. If, however, the decision was unclear to the Supreme Sanhedrin, they deliberate about the matter at that time and debate it back and forth until they reach a uniform decision or until a vote is taken. In such a situation, they allow the majority, they follow the majority, and then tell all the questioners, this is the halakha. The questioners then all depart. After the Supreme Sanhedrin was nullified, differences of opinion multiplied among the Jewish people. One would rule an article is impure and support his ruling with a rationale, and another would rule that it is pure and support his ruling with a rationale. This one would rule an article is forbidden, and this would rule that it is permitted.
So was born Rabbi Shapin.
Go on, we'll discuss all this.
The following rules apply when there are two sages or two courts that have differing opinions in an age when there was no Supreme Sanhedrin, or during the time when the Supreme Sanhedrin was still undecided concerning the matter, whether in one age or in two different ages. One rules that an article is pure, and one rules that it is impure. One forbids an article's use, and one permits it. If one does not know in which direction the law tends, should the matter involve a question of scriptural law, follow the more severe opinion. If it involves a question of rabbinic law, follow the more lenient option.
Ah, okay. So here's the deal. The way the Rambam presents it like this. The Sanhedrin got booted out, got shut down, and had to be on the run around the year 40. About 40 years before the end of the destruction of the temple. The temple was destroyed. You know, everybody, those who were on my tour, we saw the stones, the Herodian stones piled up, which the Roman conquerors did. Though 40 years before that, the Sanhedrin was booted out, had to go on the run, and left the Beit HaMikdash. So before that, if you had a question, you went to your town. If you didn't know your town or your court, you go to the first court in the Temple Mount. If they didn't know, they bound to the second court in the Temple Mount. And if they didn't know, they bound to the Supreme Court. And then if they'd have a debate about it, you'd go by the majority. So basically, you had a vehicle to resolve every single case. There was never a doubt. Then you get it. Then now there's no Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin ceased. So now we have a situation like this. If there's a dispute, and if there's a dispute about something biblical, where do we go? What's the law? If there's a doubt about something which is a biblical law, what is the halacha?
You go with the more stringent opinion.
Right, because what they call Safek Doraisa L'chumra. When in doubt about a biblical law, you go strict. Let's say it's rabbinic law.
You go lenient, L'chumra.
You go lenient. But then Sean's question is, one second, isn't not following a rabbinic law also a biblical law? So how could you have this law?
It's not established by the Sanhedrin as law, so it's a little bit different.
No, but let's say they're debating an issue about a rabbinic issue. One goes strict, one goes two. You have two competing positions.
Well, they're both protecting the same biblical commandments, but because of we don't have the legal system in place, we can follow the less strict opinion for offense.
Right, you're right. No, you're not violating the rabbinic law. You're following the rabbinic law. The question is, what is the rabbinic law? The problem of violating rabbinic law, which also a biblical law, is when a person just saying, like, I'm just not going to do this. Here, your question is, we're not sure what is the rabbinic law. Is it the strict position or the lenient position? For example, in the laws of avelut, mourning for a relative, except for the first day, like Shiva and Shloshim and the 12 months, it's all rabbinic law. Biblical mourning, according to the Rambam, is only one day, assuming that the burial, that the death and burial occur within the same 24-hour period. Others hold this all rabbinic. So when in doubt about, when in doubt, when you have a dispute about laws of a loot, we go what?
Lenient.
We go lenient. We go lenient. Okay, so let's, okay, before I go on, is this, it's a lot of material. So do we see what the role of the Sanhedrin was? What was their three basic roles? Was one role which had three different functions?
Well, to protect the laws of the Torah is their number one thing.
Well, that demands that they would a...
And they had to do three different things to apply it.
So you have the identifying the definitions, the Torah Shabbat Peh, the oral law definitions of terms in the Chumash, in the Tanakh, and therefore the law. A, using certain laws of interpretation to get new laws. And three, making brand new legislations, whether it be customs, gezerot, or takanot, to strengthen the Jewish community's adherence of the Torah itself. Now, so can an individual rabbi ever uproot any particular mitzvah in the Torah?
No.
First of all, you know, even the Sanhedrin can't do that. Okay? And certainly not an individual rabbi. So that's number one. So what has become of Jew is Torah Shabbat Peh the same? Here's my question. Is the oral law the same size it was at the year 40? Has it gotten smaller or bigger or stayed the same? What do you say?
It should be the same. Because without the Sanhedrin now and without the Beit HaMikdash now, we're not supposed to be making new laws. But you could make the case that it's gotten bigger because you have so many more rabbis that are now interpreting to apply it to the modern day.
Correct. So, for example, there was no artificial insemination in the year 40. So when Rav Moshe Feinstein got the question, could a Jew utilize the technology, the fertility technology of artificial insemination, he's not making a new law. He's taking the existing principle articulated by the Sanhedrin, codified in what book? Where did the corpus of Jewish law get initially solidified?
The Mishnah?
Nope. Close. The Talmud. The Talmud's discussions of the Mishnah, when they came to what they call when they came to a conclusion, those became binding on the Jewish people. So when a modern day legal decisor, or we call a posig, he's not making a new law because he is not a Sanhedrin. What he's doing is, based upon the laws and the principles already established, he's applying it to a new circumstance. So in a certain sense, the oral law is growing every day. Because new situations, questions come up. And the application from the known to the unknown, the derivation, is what the posig does. But doesn't have a power to make new legislation or the power to undo legislation. You know what I'm saying? That we need to have a Sanhedrin back in business with. And there's been throughout Jewish history an effort to restart the Sanhedrin, which is a class in its own right. Okay? Because obviously if you have a Sanhedrin, you could do a lot more. All right? So but basically when a person let me just share a couple things. Typically, most questions that a person will ask a rabbi is a question that's already known. You know what I'm saying? What I call, you know, as a rabbi, I'm going to get the top 5,000 questions that have been asked, you know, before, and it's really clarifying the halakha to that case. It's not making a new insight. You know what I'm saying? It's sort of applying a known to another known. You know what I'm saying? Then we get a psak, which is dealing with a novel case and having to extract the principles of the known cases to the unknown case. That's really called psak. The third thing is, which we talked about today, is when the Sanhedrin actually made brand new halakhos, either biblical by using the laws of derivation of the Torah, new biblical laws, they're making new biblical laws. Or they're making rabbinic laws to protect the Torah, whether making customs or institutions or legislation. Okay. I kind of sort of in a short amount of time sort of given you the short version, which is sourced in our parsha about what is the source and limit of rabbinic authority. Is this clear? Okay, that's not too bad. it gets far more complicated than this, but this is sort of like a very nice, I think, a nice overview of the basics of how the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law, works. So if you want to, you could say, if you want to reduce it down to a bumper sticker, you can really say it like this, that Judaism really is the oral law. You know what I'm saying? In other words, the Christians denied much or most of the oral law. In fact, they denied not only the oral law, they denied the binding nature of everything other than the Ten Commandments. Okay? So what gives Judaism its character is really the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law, the understanding of what the verses are talking about, and the subsequent expansion, derivation, and other principles. So basically, in a bumper sticker, Judaism is the oral law. That's why the Karaites and before them the Sadducees, they denied the oral law, and they say all there is the written law. So that's why that was a major schism. But the oral law is everything. All right, that's the essential point I wanted to make tonight. So All right, I want to keep it. I don't make it more complicated. All right, is that clear? All right. Well, I'll take clear. All right. All right, guys. So have yourself a wonderful night. And
welcome back. Thank you.
Get some rest.
Got it.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Bye. Thank you. Bye.